Trump says out today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump ended months of speculation regarding U.S. participation in the Paris Climate Agreement.
The United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord.
Good news for some people in North Dakota.
Let's just keep a conservative way of looking at the industry and also what we're trying to do in harmony with the planet, and hopefully it works out.
But not in the Marshall Islands.
If the wave comes in, take it away. There will be no Marshall Islands because of the climate change.
If not Paris, then what? That and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It's official. President Trump has announced his decision to pull the U.S. out of the Paris climate deal. Speaking at the White House this afternoon, Trump said he will cease implementation of the accord, which called for the U.S. to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions. But he also said he would begin new negotiations to possibly re-enter a global climate deal of some sort. Trump said the current deal would have cost millions of Americans jobs and slow economic production. Here's an excerpt from his Rose Garden announcement today.
The rest of the world applauded when we signed the Paris Agreement. They went wild. They were so happy. For the simple reason that it put our country, the United States of America, which we all love, at a very, very big economic disadvantage. A cynic would say the obvious reason for economic competitors and their wish to see us remain in the agreement is so that we continue to suffer this self-inflicted major economic wound. We would find it very hard to compete with other countries from other parts of the world.
President Trump speaking earlier today. Joining me now in the studio is the world's environment editor, Peter Thompson, and reporter, Carolyn Beeler. For both of you, Carolyn and Peter, what were the key takeaways to this announcement in the Rose Garden, aside from the big headline that the U.S. is pulling out of the Paris deal?
Well, I think it's typical Donald Trump. He sees the U.S. as being the victim here. He sees us as being at the butt end of everybody else's joke, of everybody else's scheming, and that we are not going to put up with that anymore. We're going to fight back. To my mind, and I've been following this for 25 years, I was at the Framework Convention where the Framework Convention was hashed out in Rio in 1992. It represents a complete misunderstanding of the nature of the problem, the scope of the problem. He cites entirely all the most perhaps extreme cost analyses of what this will cost us, but none of the cost of what climate change will cost us, and none of the benefits of what many people say a new green economy will bring to us as well.
Carolyn, what about for you? What was the big takeaway?
Some of the same things that Peter said. Also wanted to highlight that President Trump talked a lot about fairness and the fact that India and China could keep burning coal and growing, whereas the U.S. was going to be hampered. And I sort of had two reactions to that. First, the commitments that the U.S. and every other country made under the Paris Agreement were nationally determined. So the U.S. had control over what it said it would do. China had control over what it said it would do. So that was sort of our own making, what we said we would do. And then if you look at this on the global timescale, you know, the U.S. has done a lot more historically since the industrial era to contribute to this problem. And so saying that we are being unduly hampered by trying to do some part of reducing it sort of has a very narrow view of what fairness means in sort of in terms of global climate change. And that's something that I believe developing countries will be commenting on going forward.
Yeah, what's the truth? Is the U.S. getting a rough deal on this, Peter?
Well, unfairness is still completely in the eye of the beholder. And first of all, we are still the largest historic emitter of greenhouse gases over since the Industrial Revolution by far. China is currently the largest annual emitter, but we are still among the top two per capita emitters in the world. We emit twice as much per capita, roughly, than China does. So who's getting the short end of the stick in terms of trying to bring that down? We are at a much higher level of development than China is. Nobody can argue with that. What the Paris Agreement was meant to do was to give China, India, Brazil, the rest of the developing world some room to grow, to come up to roughly where we already are and get a lot of the benefits that we have already had. and that we have also the economic wherewithal to change our economy and green our economy in a way that they don't yet themselves. So, yes, you could say that in one way it looks very unfair to the United States. In other ways, it looks like we have the ability to do a lot better, and we are giving the rest of the world a bit of a leash to get up to where we are.
Peter and Carolyn, stick around. I want to bring in Paul Bodner. He's a former Obama administration climate change negotiator, and he's currently at the Rocky Mountain Institute. Paul, thanks for being here. What is the U.S. pulling out due to the larger agreement, do you think?
Well, I think it's a sad day for U.S. standing in the world, and a big misreading of the economics here. The president laid out a vision of the American economy that goes back to the era of the steam engine, practically. So I don't know whether he also plans to make typewriters great again. But what actually is an engine of the U.S. economy is renewable energy. It's among the fastest growing areas of the economy. There are, for every coal miner in the United States today, there are 5 people working in the solar industry and 3 million Americans overall working in clean energy. So it's puzzling to me why the president, who professes to speak for business, ignored a relatively unanimous warning from major American businesses not to withdraw from the agreement, including Exxon and coal companies. And he'll have presumably some explaining to do with his constituencies there. I am pretty confident that the agreement as a whole is going to withstand this blow. It was painstakingly crafted to be designed around the self-interest of countries. And one of the big changes we've seen since the Kyoto era, since the last time this happened, is that climate action has gone from being a hair shirt, something that countries were being pressured to do but didn't really want to do, to something that they actually did want to do because they understand the other benefits of moving to a clean energy economy. I mean, who really wants a coal-fired power station next door when you can have solar panels? And so I think you're going to see that reaction from the international community. You know, we're going to move on, and the U.S. can be isolated, but this is not going to derail.
As far as that international community, I mean, those comments near the end of what Trump said, negotiations to re-enter the agreement, is there a hunger among people in the Trump camp to do that?
No, unfortunately, I think they totally misunderstand the international community's view here. There's not going to be any appetite to renegotiate this agreement. First of all, it was negotiated substantially around U.S. interests. That is why we have a Paris Agreement that's very different from the Kyoto Protocol. And so there is not going to be an appetite to renegotiate, and I think he'll find there's no one on the other side of the table.
Paul Bodner, a former Obama administration climate change negotiator, thanks very much for your time and for your reaction today.
Thanks for having me.
No matter what's happening in Washington, there are many businesses in the U.S. that will continue to go green. They see it as practical and logical, given climate science. But politically, it seems it's conservatives in America who still don't view climate change as a priority. The World's Jason Margolis has been speaking with a lot of conservatives and Trump supporters about this, and he's here with us now. Jason, where were you last, and who did you speak with?
So I was in Williston, North Dakota, and I spoke with the mayor there. It's a small town. The mayor is Howard Klug, a town of 26,000. It is a deeply conservative place. Any guesses for what percentage of the county went for Donald Trump in the presidential election?
So this is an area that's got a lot of fossil fuels, right?
But it's an oil town, yes.
Somewhere between 75 and 80.
Very good. 79%.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. Nailed it.
So impressive. So I sat down with Klug, and I asked him how people in his town feel about climate change.
We're not concerned about climate change. You know, we live in North Dakota. It's cold in the winter and it's hot in the summer. The climate change, is it real? There are things that we need to do better in our country to make sure that the pollution standards and the standards that may affect the climate change are regulated somewhat. But in the same light, it's a big planet. We've been around here a long time. Things have changed over the eons. I don't believe that what we're doing out here in Western North Dakota to mine the energy and those kind of things is affecting the climate.
Marco, I have to tell you that I'm out there talking to conservatives a lot, and asking about climate change, for whatever reason, is one of the most uncomfortable topics. I can ask about abortion. I could ask about war. But when I ask about climate change, their faces kind of drop. So listen to me asking the mayor why that is.
Why do conservatives, when I ask them about climate change, they kind of clench up?
Because the policies, they threaten their jobs. And if you're a coal miner, if you're an oil worker, they're not going to destroy the planet or do anything like that. There are ways that you can control the carbon. There are ways that you can capture the gas, the methane, and those kind of things. And that's why people get rankled up a little bit right off the bat. They just...
But when scientists say that the scientific consensus is that we need to be putting less carbon in the air if we want to save the planet, you don't buy that?
I buy it in a way. Sure, let's keep the carbon out of the air, keep it out of the atmosphere and those kind of things. But there's ways to do that. And does it have to be shut down until we've totally figured that out? No, I don't think so. Just keep working toward that point. You know, we've got a big world and it's healed itself. It can heal itself. I really believe that. So let's just keep a conservative way of looking at the industry and also what we're trying to do in harmony with the planet, and hopefully it works out. I'm sure it will.
So it sounds like you believe you're not arguing with the scientists, but you're also pro-growth at the same time. Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely. The scientists, well, they're scientists. They're the ones that change the world and come up with ideas, theories that have been proven in most cases correct. They've helped the world population, whether they're medical, whether they're climate people, whether they're engineers. But the other part of it is growth.
So that was really fascinating, Jason. I mean, the first time we heard from Mayor Klug, he said he's not concerned about climate change. He said change is constant. Temperatures go up, they go down. And I was wondering, is he really convinced by that? But it sounds like that second excerpt from your conversation sounded like Mayor Klug's really concerned about jobs, his community, and ultimately his own job as mayor.
Right. I mean, I can't get inside of his head. No one can. And I've talked to a lot of people out there who are just anti-science. They think, for whatever reason, they think scientists are lying to us. He's not one of those guys. He's a small town mayor. His town depends on oil, and oil causes climate change. So he's in a bit of a conundrum. He's got people telling him, you're destroying the planet. But if he doesn't pump the oil out of the ground, his town is not going to prosper.
So we know the science. What can mayors like Mayor Klug be told, or how can Washington help them?
That's a really tough one. I mean, they have oil under the ground. So they're being told by environmentalists, you can't get it. And to them, it's money. It means rec centers. It means new schools. It means new hospitals. It's a tough one.
The World's Jason Margolis, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And I'm joined once again by the World's Environment Desk, editor Peter Thompson and reporter Carolyn Beeler. Peter, just to get back to Donald Trump's announcement this afternoon at the White House that he is pulling the U.S. out of the Paris climate deal. The 2 degrees Celsius goal, keeping average temperature rise below that, that's a number the international community agreed upon. Do we have any sense as to whether the White House sees that number differently? Do they have any science behind their arguments?
I certainly haven't seen it. Scott Pruitt, the EPA administrator, who has been a longtime critic of climate policy, essentially says that, as Donald Trump has, that it's bunk. He says we need a lot more study. We don't really know what's going on. Most of the world's relevant scientists say we do know what's going on. What's going on is we have very little room to move in terms of the amount of carbon dioxide equivalent we can release into the atmosphere before things get really dangerous. And this makes keeping that from happening much, much more difficult.
Carolyn, now that we know the U.S. is pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement, what does that mean practically? Is there kind of a calendar for this to roll out?
So the announcement today in the Rose Garden was big on vision, not huge on details. But if the U.S. chooses to just pull out of the Paris Agreement, which is what it sounds like, you know, President Trump wants to do, that will take almost four years to finalize. So there's a 3-year period after the agreement was finalized, which was this past November, in which countries cannot formally pull out. And then once a country notifies that it wants to be removed from the agreement, there's a year waiting period. So The earliest this could be finalized would be actually November of 2020, the day after the 2020 presidential election. So none of this is going to happen quickly, although the U.S. could stop immediately attending meetings and contributing to all of the negotiations and conversations around the Paris Agreement.
That's Carolyn Beeler and Peter Thompson, both from the World's Environment Desk. Thanks very much for your thoughts.
Thanks, Marco.
Thank you, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World.
I read the news today, oh boy.
50 years ago, this song by the Beatles prompted this letter from a BBC official to the head of the band's record label.
Dear Sir Joseph, I never thought the day would come when we would have to put a ban on an EMI record. But sadly, that is what has happened over this track. We have listened to it over and over again with great care, and we cannot avoid coming to the conclusion that the words, "I'd love to turn you on," followed by that mounting montage of sound, could have a rather sinister meaning.
The Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band turns 50 this week. The album turned a lot of people on, musically and in so many other ways too. But perhaps the most radical turn-on came with the album's comfortable navigation around mind-altering substances, marijuana and LSD specifically. Simon Warner is the author of Text, Drugs, and Rock and Roll.
Around 66, 67, as they were making this album, they were really all powerful. They were omnipotent in the world of popular music making. And I think in a climate when mores and attitudes to drugs were changing.
Well, do you think you have now encouraged your fans to take drugs?
I don't think it'll make any difference. You know, I don't think my fans are going to take drugs just because I did, you know.
The Beatles wanted to be standard bearers for this new countercultural position. I think it's as simple as that. They wanted to spread an ideology that they actually believed in.
So you write about the story that may or may not be true of how the Beatles were first introduced to marijuana specifically. It kind of suggests how pervasive marijuana at least had become by 1967. Can you just share that kind of chain of custody of who smoked when and what?
Yes, there is a story that in 1940, the jazz saxophonist Lester Young met a young would-be writer called Jack Kerouac in a New York bar. And he was the first to turn Kerouac onto this drug. In the 1950s, Kerouac met an up-and-coming journalist called Al Aronovitz, who worked for the New York Daily Post. Aronovitz was very interested in subcultural scenes in the city, and I think he'd searched Kerouac out. But indeed, Kerouac turned him onto the cigarettes. At the very start of the 1960s, Aronovitz, who was now something of a figure on the scene, encountered a fresh-faced boy from the Midwest called Bob Dylan, who just turned up in the village, and he gave Dylan his first experience of the drug. And then extraordinarily, in 1964, when Aronovitz got Dylan and the Beatles together in a rather posh hotel called Hotel Delmonico in Manhattan, the Beatles then had their first experience.
He didn't actually give us it. He was in the room.
So he was not the supplier?
No. Bob Dylan's your dealer.
So there was this very interesting chain of connections from the 1940s, jazz men, all the way through to these British invaders, the Beatles, in 1964.
And the Hotel Delmonico today is?
It now carries the name Trump Park Avenue. Can you believe it? So the president actually owns that particular space.
Yeah, the circuit is completed in some surreal way. So if you are a narc and looking for them, what other drug references can you find on Sgt. Pepper?
Well, there are quite a few, Marco. Let's start with perhaps an obvious one in Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. It's quite easy to turn that title into the acronym LSD.
Lucy!
John Lennon, extraordinarily, who'd been taking LSD for a year or two, he denied any connection between the title of that song and the actual drug.
Has it ever been settled whether Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds was a code for anything?
It never was, and nobody believes me. This is the truth. My son came home with a drawing and showed me this strange-looking woman flying around. I said, "What is it?" He said, "It's Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds." And I thought, that's beautiful. I immediately wrote a song about it.
But I think it's quite implausible, because if you listen to the song, this is really the description of a psychedelic trip.
I mean, the Beatles disavowed a lot of these drug references in their music, not just on Sgt. Pepper, right?
Yes, they did. Fixing a Hole is sometimes thought to be a junkie needle reference. This was also denied. And the more sort of metaphorical, with a little help from my friends, this was thought to be a possible reference to drug use. It's also worth saying that at a time when commentators were really looking for these connections, you know, they would search them out. And if we're thinking about a day in the life, phrases like "I'd love to turn you on" are plainly the language of the day. They are linked to people saying, "Can I get you high?" There is this central section where Paul McCartney joins the fun and talks about going upstairs, having a smoke. Somebody spoke, went into a dream. And there's a clear connection, at least on the face of it, between, you know, smoking a cigarette that wasn't just tobacco and having some sort of trippy experience.
Yeah, it is really hard to avoid all those connections. Just place this album and its drug references in the context of the moment, because this was 1967, the Summer of Love, right?
The Summer of Love. I mean, this was a time when there was a sort of belief that maybe these intriguing psychedelic substances could make the world a better place, could make people more connected with the world that they were in. I mean, you know, the early 1960s, we saw important figures like Timothy Leary, who was a Harvard psychology professor, stand up and say LSD could be the way for people to lead better lives, see the world in a different way. And certainly by around 1965, LSD was spreading into the sort of elite celebrity circles. Certainly the Beatles were taking LSD by the mid-60s. And in the USA, this drug was only made illegal in 1966. Mm. So it's still regarded as a sort of suitable recreational narcotic if you wanted to take it.
So, I mean, you write that Sgt. Pepper was the first time that the Beatles published their song lyrics on the back cover of the album. How do you think focusing on lyrics and words like this gave power to the words like never before?
This was a big step forward. I think until the Beatles did what they did, there was an assumption that pop song lyrics, certainly those of the rock and roll era, the late 50s, early 60s, were just inconsequential, moon in June, boy meets girl words. Mm. The Beatles clearly wrote a body of lyrics here that had much more depth and reflection, and these were much deeper, sometimes darker themed. I think we can say that because individuals like Bob Dylan and the Beatles were friends with figures like Allen Ginsberg, the great promoter of beat poetry, his own poetry, I think they were influenced by that kind of element. Ginsberg sort of sought the power that rock stardom could bring to him. But figures like Dylan and the Beatles also wanted to bring literary credibility to the kind of work they were doing. They wanted to escape the showbiz manacles. And the Beatles, by doing this kind of thing, started to do that.
Simon Warner, author of Text, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. This is a take one.
Take one from the new Outtakes box set of Sgt. Pepper's, the 50th anniversary edition. Pretty interesting stuff if you're into the artist sketchbook and process, which I am. You're listening to The World. Marco Werman. President Trump announces the U.S. will leave the Paris Climate Accord. It's all about American sovereignty, he says.
We don't want other leaders and other countries laughing at us anymore, and they won't be. They won't be.
Climate change hits home. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We understand people better when we know their story, right? Well, yesterday we started to do that with Bartolo. He's a teenager from Guatemala who traveled north to find work here in the U.S. When we left off, he was living in Pittsburgh, working in a restaurant and waiting for an immigration hearing. And then he met someone who was about to play a key role in his life. Erica Barras picks up the story.
It was 2014, and Grace Mueller was working at Casa San Jose, a local nonprofit that helps new immigrants. She was mostly assisting teenagers who had crossed the border on their own.
Those kids needed everything. They came with just, like, no clothes. The houses they were staying in had no food. A lot of the times the people they were staying with were, like, vaguely related to them.
Bartolo was one of those kids. The two formed an unlikely friendship.
Bartolo is a very special kid. He's very special to me, and then he's also just a special kid. He's very sweet. He will check in with me out of the blue. How's your day? Are you at work today? I'm like, yes, it's Monday, so I am at work today.
He confided in her right from the start. Bartolo told her how he was surviving, working at a Chinese restaurant and living in a house with his cousin and about a dozen other men. Grace helped Bartolo out with all kinds of things. But then one day, she got an alarming text. He had what he called a bubble on his back.
This just kept growing, first a little, so I thought it was just an allergy. But then it kept growing, and I didn't know what was happening to me.
And I was like, listen, I'm not there, and I don't know anything about back bubbles or growths, and you need to see a doctor about that.
Bartolo listened to her. With his cousin, he went to the hospital to find out what was wrong. It turned out a lot was. The bubbles were related to Pott's disease, or spinal tuberculosis. He had a potentially fatal heart murmur, and he needed glasses. At 5'3", he weighed just 90 pounds. Hospital staff wrote in his records that he was possibly malnourished. But getting treated was tricky. He was a minor, and even though the U.S. government had placed him with his cousin when he entered the country, his cousin wasn't actually his legal custodian. No one was.
So here he was, a kid who's maybe 16, and he can't sign the papers. He can't make informed decision about his own health care, but no one else could either.
Mueller realized that for this scenario, there wasn't an obvious solution.
No one seemed to know what to do to handle a kid that doesn't have health insurance, that doesn't speak English, and needed a lot of follow-up care.
It was a case for the courts.
I'm Judge Eleanor Bush. I'm a judge of the Allegheny County Court of Common Pleas, assigned to our family division.
Bush isn't an immigration judge, but she ends up handling juvenile migrant cases because there isn't anywhere else for these kids to go. Judges like her can rule on custody issues, and they can make recommendations to the federal government. In Bartolo's case, she recommended he petition for special immigrant juvenile status.
That category, special immigrant juvenile, applies to children who have been abused, neglected, or abandoned by one or both parents. And that abuse could have happened in the country that the child came from, or it could be something that happened here.
Bartolo had never seen a doctor before arriving in the United States. That was normal back home, where the closest doctor was 5 hours away. But here, that could be considered neglect.
I am a state court judge in the state of Pennsylvania, so I need to apply Pennsylvania law to the situations that I see.
But because he was a minor, Bartolo's parents still needed to be involved, even from Guatemala, which meant calling them and overcoming a language barrier.
I speak another language. It's called Chew.
Bartolo's parents don't speak Spanish. They speak an indigenous language, Chew. Even with a translator, there aren't words in Chew that translate to the words they were hearing from Judge Bush.
I do find it very challenging to explain to them, here's where we are. I'm in a court. Do you know what a court is? You have a right to a lawyer. Do you know what a lawyer is?
But they got through the conversations. In the end, the court placed him in an orphanage. As a ward of a state, he was entitled to medical care. And perhaps most important, he was granted the special immigrant juvenile status the judge had recommended him for.
He's probably the only case that I can recall with these unaccompanied minors cases that's really turning on a medical problem, a medical issue.
This is attorney Joyce Gallagher Ramirez, who represented Bartolo.
And for sure, if his situation hadn't been detected and you know, treated, and he was sent back to Guatemala, he would have died. I mean, that there's just no two ways about that.
The people around him, they all say the same thing. Him being so sick ended up being kind of lucky because it eventually got him approved for this immigration status, and that got him a work permit and a social security number and allowed him to apply for a coveted green card. That was 2 years ago. Today, Grace Mueller, the woman who kind of saved Bartolo's life by sending him to the hospital, is still a big part of it.
I wouldn't call it a friendship. I'm an adult woman and this is a teenager, but I don't know. I wouldn't even want to call it a mentorship, but I care a lot about him and I still try and spend a lot of time with him.
Once a month, she takes him out for breakfast. She asks about the cousin he lived with when he first came here. He's since returned to Guatemala. They talk music, telenovelas, and weekend plans. Mueller tells Bartolo she came home from work last night, man started watching Netflix, and never got around to dinner. Bartolo says that happens to him all the time when he likes a movie. After breakfast, Mueller will drop Bartolo off at his new foster home. It's been a big adjustment. We'll hear about that tomorrow in the next chapter of the story. For The World, Erica Burris, Pittsburgh.
Tomorrow, we meet Bartolo's foster mom.
I want him to be successful here. You know, I don't want him just to get by. So just like I push my other kids, I push him too. Okay, that's great, but now what's the next thing? How can we do more?
Like it or not, Donald Trump is a rule breaker as president. We all know he loves to tweet. But even hardened Trump watchers were surprised this week to learn that he still uses his personal cell phone to make and take calls. And not just private calls, but important diplomatic business. The AP and others report that he's been giving his number out to foreign leaders and asking them to call him directly. Noah Shachtman is executive editor of The Daily Beast, but also a bit of a security technology buff. What's wrong with the president using his personal mobile phone? Why are security experts freaking out?
They're freaking out because cell phones are inherently insecure, especially if you're the number one target of foreign intelligence services in the world. Look, everybody at every spy headquarters on the planet wants to know what Trump is saying, right? And, you know, if he doesn't have a secure device to talk, the chances are pretty good that they're going to be able to listen in.
You mean there's no technological resources in the U.S. government that can figure out a way to secure a personal cell phone?
There are lots of ways in which the U.S. government can secure a phone call, but it can't really be done with an off-the-shelf commercial phone that you or I buy. The phone has to be hardened. Most of the apps have to be taken off, et cetera, et cetera. It's the kind of thing you can do. You can build a secure device, but, you know, the phone Trump's had in his pocket for the last couple of years, that ain't going to be the secure device.
So let's say Trump's phone line is being used. He's talking on it. How can someone eavesdrop on that conversation? How hard is that?
For you and I, it's extremely difficult. For a big intelligence service, it's laughably easy.
When you say laughably easy, like how easy is it for that intelligence service?
Look, so all of all phone calls have a bit of encryption, but that encryption is not hard for a industrial strength intelligence service to break. Look, you see this all the time. You know, there are plenty of police departments and the FBI use a kind of technology called stingrays to intercept cell phone locations and conversations all the time. And I think you can bet that foreign intelligence services would want to do the same.
It really does feel like this is another example of Trump feeling like rules don't apply to him. But Barack Obama, wasn't he essentially forced to give up his beloved BlackBerry after he won in 2008? How come no one can force President Trump to do the same?
I think because, as we've seen over the years, Obama's more of a rule follower, right? He was a law professor. And, you know, whatever you think of Obama, he basically seemed to color inside the lines. Trump does anything but. And so I think when he gets told, "Sir, Mr. President, you got to give up your personal cell phone," you know, he shouts, "Make America great again," and, you know, dials his buddy Justin Trudeau or something like that.
Well, apparently it's funny you mentioned that because apparently Justin Trudeau, the Canadian prime minister, has called Trump's personal mobile since he got the number. What does a foreign leader open themselves up to when they call Trump's unsecured line?
Yeah, that's a good question. It depends a little bit on what kind of line they're talking on. But certainly it's going to be less secure than if Trump's carrying a hardened, you know, government issue phone.
Is there any way to tell if your cell phone conversation is being monitored? Is there an app for that?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I think you can assume pretty much that if you're John Q. Public, your phone calls are not being monitored. I think you can assume, however, that somewhere in some vast repository of data that either your cell provider or the NSA is, you know, keeping some records on who you call and when and where you were during that phone call. The chances of that data actually being used, if you're John Q. Public, are infinitesimally small, but that data does get recorded somewhere and could be used by the government.
Noah, do you have Trump's number?
Yeah, it's 867-5309.
I mean, there's no 411 for cell phones. Is it possible to just kind of find out what it is?
I am sure there are many, many White House reporters or people that followed Trump on the campaign trail or folks that followed Trump during his business career that have Trump's personal cell number.
Noah Shachtman, executive editor for The Daily Beast. Thank you, as always.
Thanks for having me.
Cell phones, a potential espionage weapon. But remember, there can be no liberation without the bulldozer. That's a quote from Muhammad Ali al-Shwili, a 19-year-old private in the Iraqi National Army. He's part of the push to liberate parts of the Iraqi city of Mosul that are still under ISIS control. We're talking densely populated neighborhoods where the fighting happens block by block. And the only thing that will break through is a bulldozer. Thomas Gibson Neff wrote about this for The Washington Post. Are these specialty military bulldozers, Thomas, or bulldozers you'd see at a construction site?
These are definitely specialty military bulldozers. They're called D7R2s, and they're basically the bulldozer that you would see at a construction site modified for military use. So it has more armor. The driver's compartment is much more reinforced and actually has an escape hatch in case, you know, it rolls over or gets hit or knocked out. So it's definitely a lot more fearsome looking than one of the big yellow dozers you might see driving down the road.
Right. So what physically can one of these military equipped bulldozers actually do?
Everything that a normal bulldozer would, they can just do it while they're getting shot at by a litany of different types of weapons. The Iraqis will use them primarily to clear obstacles, to provide cover for advancing troops. They'll put the front blade in an elevated position to kind of guard the armored glass of the bulldozer as it goes forward to deflect rocket-propelled grenades. And then when they're kind of in a defensive position, they'll put the blade down to intercept any car bombs that come at them.
Why would the Iraqi forces use these specialty bulldozers instead of a tank, which would seem to be able to do all the jobs?
Right. Well, tanks are much wider. They need more people to operate, especially if it has a gun on it. So what these things can do is basically do everything a tank can, but also at the end of the day, if these advancing forces need to fortify their position, they just put the thing down and maybe move a car into the middle of a street to block it. Meanwhile, a tank would probably just run over the car because it doesn't have a bulldozer blade up front.
Where are the Iraqi forces getting these bulldozers?
So these come through the Pentagon, and I think they have well over 100 bulldozers. So it's just one of the things that the U.S. sends, you know, anti-tank weapons, rifles, machine guns, and also armored bulldozers.
So I mentioned that great quote, there can be no liberation without the bulldozer. That was one of the people you interviewed, Private Muhammad Ali al-Shwili. Tell us about him.
Al-Shwili is 19. He very much wanted to be in the infantry on the front lines, and they put him in a logistics battalion. And next thing you know, he's driving a bulldozer in some of the fighting in Anbar province. So he's a very young guy. And a lot of these guys I talk to, you know, they see this as a job where they're protecting their troops, kind of like the highest honor, I guess, for them. And they know that when they go out there, there's a very high likelihood that they're most likely going to be injured and a high chance that they're going to be killed as well.
I mean, the bulldozers seem to be vital to fighting ISIS, but they're also pretty vulnerable. Ali al-Shwili has had some close calls, you report.
Right, yeah. So the video in the article is him catching a car bomb with the front of his bulldozer kind of in the last second before it explodes. He kind of pivots right and pushes it up against the wall, making it explode against the wall. And he was fine except for some shrapnel in his left arm and shoulder. That's one of his close calls, but his bulldozer has been knocked out. His friends have been killed because basically, you know, these things are 10 feet off the ground. So when they come down a street, it just makes total sense for the Islamic State to target them with everything they have, because if they knock out a bulldozer, that's a vital piece of the Iraqis' defense that they can now get around. They can send car bombs, they can, you know, advance on them, etc.
When did the bulldozer become so crucial for the Iraqi forces?
I mean, really, I think it became crucial when they started offensive operations. You know, you look at 2004 Fallujah, when the U.S. Marines went in, they were using these bulldozers on loan from the Israeli army, which are gigantic. I mean, 15, 20 feet high, to bulldoze buildings that they couldn't clear. So it's always had a role in urban warfare. But I think when the Iraqis, with their kind of heavy reliance on U.S. fire support and this kind of piece-by-piece, step-by-step advancing style, it really gained new relevance. Right when they started retaking Ramadi, was one of their first big offensive operations. It's just one of the things that you kind of see is bred out of necessity, right? It's how they're fighting, and this is kind of the perfect vehicle to facilitate that fight.
Back to our top story now. This afternoon, President Trump announced his decision to pull the U.S. out of the Paris climate deal. Trump said the agreement and its mandate to reduce emissions would cost millions of American jobs and slow down economic production. He also said he wants to negotiate a better climate deal if possible. That's the view from the White House today, but all of this looks a lot different from the ground level in places already under threat from climate change. Melting ice and rising sea levels have a big effect on Pacific island nations like the Marshall Islands, which share a long and troubling history with the U.S. Reporter Ibi Caputo recently visited Springdale, Arkansas, home to the largest Marshallese community in the U.S.
Chris Ballos remembers learning about climate change when he was in high school. He was living in Sacramento, California, and at the time, climate change felt like somebody else's problem. But then Chris started to see the problem in Facebook posts from his family and friends back home.
Pictures of homes being flooded, or last time I heard, it got so bad that even the hospital was flooded.
Chris was born in the Marshall Islands, which are low-lying coral islands in the Pacific. His homeland is vulnerable, and not just because of sea level rise. The U.S. tested dozens of nuclear bombs there. Some areas are still uninhabitable.
In Bikini Lagoon, radiological reconnaissance boats directed from low-flying aircraft will be used as safety patrol vessels. Immediately after the blast, these drone boats will capture samples of water and air. Determining the concentration of deadly radioactive particles is of the utmost importance, since invisible gamma and beta rays kill without warning.
In the 1980s, a treaty gave Marshallese immigrants the right to live and work in the U.S. without a visa. Chris came as a toddler for medical treatments. He had scoliosis. Eventually, he moved to Springdale to find work. Today, when he sees photographs of sea level rise, he feels personally affected.
These are not people 3,000 miles away. These are my family. How the hell do I just sit here and do nothing? You know, send donations? I want to do more than that.
This urge to do more inspired Chris to read up on climate change. He started sharing the Marshallese story at conferences. He's even visited Washington, D.C. to lobby Congress. And while Chris became more political, climate change became even more personal, starting with when Chris's grandma came to Arkansas. 5 years ago, Buki Matauto was living in the Marshallese capital of Majuro. She loved to garden.
Yeah, she's well known for having some of the most unique flowers on the island. So, you know, you would have, you know, people stopping by the house and looking at her garden, and sometimes she would give them some seeds.
They give them, they make canando rhythm, but I'm glad with the gun, I'm glad with the karaki.
Yeah, they would also post it on, like, the radio stations.
On the radio, they'd say, be sure to check out Buki's new flowers. But Buki had diabetes, and she needed medical care she couldn't get on the islands. She also wanted to be closer to her daughter and grandchildren, so she moved to Springdale. Chris calls his grandma Boo Boo. She's 71, and when I visit for an interview, a tear runs down her cheek. Chris wipes it away with his finger.
You know, I'm kind of emotional.
Tell me why.
I don't know. When I'm happy, I'm, you know, tears come out. When I'm sad, tears come out. Poor thing.
Also when she's nervous.
One day, Chris asked his boo-boo if she'd ever heard of climate change and sea level rise. She didn't know much about the details, but she knew what it was. She said she had seen its effects every time she tried to visit her parents' graves in Majuro.
Every time we walk, we see them. Right next to the road, people walk back and forth, and we look. Every time we look,
The white cement crosses had the names of her parents inscribed on them, along with the days they were born and died, just like tombstones here. But there's one main difference.
Ella would live where?
Ella, the tombs are not there anymore. The big wave comes. Me? Ella, you live in the middle of the middle.
King tides.
Ella?
King tides.
Yeah,
like she said, their graves are gone and there's no way of her seeing the graves anymore.
King tides are higher than usual waves that happen a few times a year. Because of rising sea level, the king tides are getting bigger. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, king tides provide a glimpse of future everyday water levels. I ask Buki how she feels about what happened to her parents' graves, or tombs as she calls them.
Well, I feel sad, but what can I do? When we walk around, we see different tombs because the old one, they're not there.
So you look at other people's tombs?
Mm-hmm.
But even though her parents' graves were washed away, Buki still wants to be buried on Majuro. Chris feels torn about this. He thinks a lot about the next generation and says he'll feel terrible if his nieces and nephews are unable to visit his boo-boo's grave. But he understands where she's coming from.
You know, it's her place. It's her home. She knows that she has no place here, same as I, like, you know, to be buried over here. But
that's where I belong.
There you go.
No place like home. I'd rather go back to Madre.
Why?
I like it better. I like the weather and the people. Nothing to worry about.
And it doesn't bother you that the king tide might come and wash away your grave?
It does. But what can I do? I don't know. I just want to bury over there, even though the wave come and take my tomb away.
So if it comes, it comes. So that's the reality of, you know, most of the people still there. But that's pretty much like, you know, that the whole Marshallese mindset at the moment.
If it comes, it comes. Chris and Buki expect higher king tides will come, which means some Marshallese people could be displaced permanently. The Marshallese will have the option to migrate to the U.S., but it's not an option they necessarily want to take.
What do you think is going to happen to Majuro? Like in the future, right now? Future or even...
Well, you might think if the wave comes and take it away. There will be no Marshall Island because of the climate change.
Buki says she prays about it because it's in God's hands. Chris thinks prayer helps, but it's not enough.
I believe in the Bible also teaches us, you know, if we have the hands to work, we work.
He says that's why he shares the Marshallese story. For The World, Ibi Caputo, Springdale, Arkansas.
And that's our show today. We'll be back tomorrow with global reaction to President Trump's announcement this afternoon that he's pulling the U.S. out of the Paris climate deal. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.